Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist Robert Parry, who takes a critical look at Barack Obama's picks to be national security advisors and cabinet officers in his new administration. Van Jones, founder of Green for All and author of The Green Collar Economy, who talks about his proposals for developing alternative energy, protecting the environment, and creating jobs. And Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses Barack Obama's economic team and lays out a progressive approach to confront the nation's current economic crisis. But first, we present some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 15 years in obscurity, Peru's notorious Shining Path guerrillas are on the rebound, fighting against an army offensive in southern Peru. According to the Washington Post, Shining Path rebels, known in Spanish as Sendero Luminoso, killed 17 soldiers and 5 civilians in October, the most people killed by the Peruvian insurgent group since the 1990s. Peru has launched a major offensive called Operation Excellence to flush out Shining Path fighters. The Shining Path force is thought to number between 400 to 700 full-time rebels. They have largely abandoned their strict Maoist ideology of Abimael Guzman, who was captured in 1992. In 2003, Peru's Truth and Reconciliation Commission estimated that 69,000 people died during fighting between the Shining Path and the Peruvian military between 1980 and 2000. Now the Shining Path is trying to build solidarity with peasants and copper mine workers. The Peruvian government dismisses the Shining Path as mere narco-terrorists, protecting coca production, which has increased 18% in the Andean region over the last 5 years. The resurgence of the Shining Path has raised concerns about new right-wing militias organizing to fight the leftist rebels, resulting in a new round of civilian deaths. Over the last year, the Bush administration orchestrated a wave of workplace raids to round up undocumented immigrants, creating a wave of fear in immigrant communities and damaging union organizing drives. In 2007, nearly 5,000 immigrants were arrested in workplace raids, according to The Nation magazine. In the first half of 2008, 3,000 have been arrested and 875 immigrants face criminal charges. In late August, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents raided Howard Industries in Laurel, Mississippi, and sent nearly 500 workers to a detention facility in Louisiana. Patricia Ice of the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance blasted the ICE raid as political, declaring they want a mass exodus of immigrants out of the state, the kind we have seen in Arizona and Oklahoma. In March, Arizona State Police arrested 11 workers at the Tucson Panda Express restaurant for having mismatched Social Security numbers. The company then fired its entire workforce and brought in new people. President-elect Obama recently named Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano as his Homeland Security Chief. Napolitano criticized the security fence being built along the U.S.-Mexican border and called for the National Guard to patrol the border zone. On the eve of the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, police raided homes of members of the anarchist group RNC Welcoming Committee. 8 people were arrested and charged with conspiracy to riot and accused of breaking Minnesota's broad anti-terrorism law. The activists face a possible sentence of 7 years in jail. The police monitored the anarchist group for a year and infiltrated it with paid informants. According to the search warrant, the county sheriff had probable cause that the group had incendiary and explosive devices. Attorney Bruce Nestor of the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild said police seized computers, paint, and hatchets used for chopping wood, but no explosive devices. The RNC 8 faces charges from a Minnesota state law with broader powers than the Federal Patriot Act. The law declares it a felony to interfere with the lawful conduct of government, commerce, or the right of assembly. At a probable cause hearing on November 10th, the defendants successfully argued for a delay to gather more evidence for their case. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. Thank you.
While President-elect Barack Obama has made it a top priority to quickly name his team of economic advisors in the midst of a deepening U.S. financial crisis, reports about who will be part of his national security team have been the subject of multiple leaks in the news media. According to news reports, current U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has agreed to stay on under President Obama for a year or so, while the president-elect's former rival for the Democratic Party nomination, New York Senator Hillary Clinton, is said to be ready to accept the new administration's offer to become Secretary of State. Other reports say retired Marine General James Jones will be named National Security Advisor. Both Gates and Clinton have a history of supporting George W. Bush's war in Iraq, echoed his bellicose threats against Iran, and backed his ineffectual policies on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. While the national security team has not yet been officially announced, those so far named seem at odds with the declaration made by Obama at a Democratic candidates' debate in Los Angeles on January 31, 2008. Where he said, quote, "I don't want to just end the Iraq war, but I want to end the mindset that got us into war in the first place." Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with award-winning investigative journalist Robert Parry, editor of ConsortiumNews.com. He takes a critical look at Barack Obama's picks for his national security team and wonders what happened to the president-elect's campaign pledge for change.
Well, he seems to be sidling very much toward the centrist Democrats and some of the Republicans who do not really mean much in the way of change. I always felt that the most interesting comment that he made during the campaign was his line that he said he did not just want to end the Iraq war, he wanted to end the mindset that got us into the war. And there, some people interpreted that in a very big way, that he really was going to try to change Washington in how it looked at power, how it looked at the idea of America being this military powerhouse that tries to bestride the world. Some people looked at it as picking up on the concepts that Dwight Eisenhower had when he warned about the military-industrial complex. Maybe Obama would address that. Maybe he'd pick up on John Kennedy's idea that we need to have a peace that's not a Pax Americana, but a real peace. So far, it seems like he's taking a very minimal view of what he meant by that. He's not really going even to people who were strong opponents of the Iraq War. He was an early opponent of the Iraq War. He seems to be turning to people who were big supporters of the Iraq War. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she was a Democrat who was very hawkish and who supported the Iraq War really until she started running for the presidency as a Democrat in 2006 or 2007. And then you have Bob Gates, who is a longtime Bush family loyalist, Republican, who has often represented some of the worst of the national security thinking in Washington. Back in the 80s, he was the key action officer when the Reagan administration wanted to break the back of the old CIA analysts who actually believed in getting the facts right and presenting them to the policymakers. It was Bob Gates who led the way in essentially politicizing the intelligence that came out of the CIA, one of the factors that led us into the Iraq War, ultimately. Bipartisanship, if it means working with people of both parties who share a sensible vision, may make some sense. That doesn't seem to be the approach Obama is taking, though. He seems to want to deal with Republicans who represent some of the worst of the Bush policies. So Obama seems not, at least assuming he follows through on some of these press reports, is not really charting a new direction.
What pressures do you think are being brought to bear on him to break with some of at least his rhetoric during the campaign, where he was, as you said, going to chart a new direction? What are the powers that be in Washington that you think he'll be confronting or has already confronted here that will challenge his worldview that things should change?
Well, one of the odd things about Washington, and I've been here 30 years or so, is that there's this conventional wisdom that takes shape often, and all the smart people, all the really good insiders all believe the same thing, or at least largely the same thing. It's a groupthink that affects the whole city. And even when you're totally wrong, as the groupthink was when in 2002 and 2003 it supported Bush's notion that there really was no alternative but to invade Iraq, that Saddam Hussein represented this existential threat to the United States somehow, that he had weapons of mass destruction, he was going to give them to Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the smart people basically thought that. And if you went to any dinner party and you espoused something else, you'd be looked at as kind of a nut. You probably would not be invited back. And so there was kind of this enforced groupthink, a little bit like Jonestown, you might say. And so it's hard to break that. Basically, almost all the Republicans and the neoconservatives dominated that thinking. But to survive in that climate, many of the Democrats essentially joined it in sort of junior partners. The Brookings Institution, it used to be a liberal institution, it became increasingly kind of a centrist, hawkish, slightly neocon light, if you will, kind of institution. So many of the so-called democratic national security thinkers were largely in line with where the Republicans were. They may have been a little bit slightly less eager, but not much. And so that's the world that Obama's coming into. And it's very difficult to go against it. It doesn't just affect the political world, it affects the journalistic world. I make a point in the story I put up today at consortiumnews.com that if you looked at the Sunday New York Times, there was in the Week in Review section, there were 7 think pieces they apparently commissioned for the view of the Iraq War and the Afghan War. And virtually everybody in there was, at one level or another, someone who supported the wars. There was not a single voice that was really anti-war, that thought this was a bad idea to sort of occupy Iraq or essentially escalate the war in Afghanistan. So the parameters remain very narrow. And if you want to be taken seriously in Washington, you often have to be wrong to be taken seriously. It's a sort of a perverse concept, but it's been the dominant concept. And I think that affects someone like Obama or anyone else who tries to come with some fresh ideas. If you embrace the people who actually were right about Iraq, you're embracing people who are largely pariahs to the Washington insider set. You're inviting trouble.
That was award-winning investigative journalist Robert Parry, author of Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Read his articles online at consortiumnews.com. President-elect Barack Obama announced on November 22nd that he plans to create 2.5 million jobs to jumpstart the economy, and many of those jobs, he says, will be green jobs, such as building wind turbines and solar panels. That was music to the ears of Van Jones, the founder of Green for All and author of The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. Jones asserts the nation's two most serious problems are the failing economy and our devastated environment. He points out that although these issues appear to be separate, they are in fact clearly connected. Jones has proposed a Green New Deal launched by the government to provide training and jobs that will reduce the nation's reliance on foreign oil and move us toward a renewable energy future. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Van Jones about Barack Obama's pledge on green jobs, possible obstacles along the way, and the role of hope in confronting a truly dire situation in the U.S. and around the world.
Yeah, I think President-elect Obama's speech is really extraordinary. The way he talks, you kind of just say, oh, yeah, it makes perfectly good sense. That was a historic speech because it indicates or signals the beginning of rebuilding the American economy on a kind of a green Keynesian footing, if you come up with a fancy term. You know, the idea that the government should spend, invest, even deficit spend, to fight off recessions, but also to invest in infrastructure that will make the country much more productive. That's an old idea in economics. It's called Keynesianism. Barack Obama's updated that and made it green. And what we're going to be investing in, is clean energy, energy independence, and all the things that are going to help the United States go from being a world leader in pollution to a world leader in solution.
Do you have any concerns about the economic team that Obama has just appointed? Many of them were of the deregulation, spend, don't save school. Are you worried that that's going to negatively impact your hopes and dreams for change?
Certainly the advisors that are around him, some of them are frankly the architects of the last economy, which just crashed. I mean, the last economy was defined by, I think, three fallacies. One, consumption, not production. For the past several years in this country, we've been consuming 5, 6, 7% more than we've been producing. We kind of sent all the factories overseas and said, oh, we'll just run our economy based on going to the mall, you know, or going to the strip mall, shopping online. Well, you know, that's not sustainable. That was the first fallacy. Second fallacy, the idea that we could run the economy forever based on debt and not smart savings or thrift like our grandparents. You know, the government was, you know, run on credit cards. The whole country's been propped up on credit cards, and that's not sustainable. And then lastly, the idea that we could run the economy based on environmental destruction rather than environmental restoration. You know, you put all the things together, especially on the environmental side, you know, we don't count what counts, which we're in right now is carbon. Carbon's off the books, free to pollute, free to dump, but it's going to cost us, according to our scientists, the whole planet. You know, these kinds of fallacies certainly characterize the last economy. Our hope is that everybody's paying attention, and you listen to all these economists now, but I think you know, people understand we've got to make a turn to, you know, back to production, back to thrift, and back to environmental restoration, and that defines the green economy. You know, my book, The Green Collar Economy, is about that kind of economy.
You talk about the story of David and Goliath, where an underdog who's excluded from the halls of power overcomes the Goliath of entrenched interests. But then you say we need to look to another story, the story of Noah and the Ark, as an organizing principle going forward. If people with a green vision were to move from thinking of ourselves as David to thinking of ourselves as Noah, what would that look like?
Most people who've been attracted to green economics and green ideas over the past period have been on the political left and not so much on the right. So that means that most of what we've got to fix to make green politics more effective and more powerful is some of the shortcomings in progressive politics. And one of the things that we have as a legacy from certainly the 1960s, if not before, is a legacy of excessively confrontational politics. A lot of we're right, everybody else is wrong, we're smart, everybody else is stupid, and the number one way we're going to get things done is to kind of publicly speak truth to power, name, blame, and shame, you know, the big evil Goliath bad guys into doing what, you know, they should. And I think, you know, there's definitely, frankly, time and place for those kinds of approaches. I just don't think that should exhaust the toolbox, especially given the stakes.
One of your key slogans, which comes out of your previous organizing work, is green jobs, not jails. In Connecticut, where I am, it costs $44,000 to keep someone in prison for a year. And just like in the rest of the country, the prisons are filled way disproportionately with blacks and Latinos. And in many ways, it's a life sentence because even when you get out, it's really hard to turn your life around when you have a criminal record. And also, resources to support people getting out of prison to get an education or a job are shrinking. Is that something you see as a rallying point, or is it too leftist or too maximalist a demand, do you think?
I don't think that the most of America would sign on to that, you know, tomorrow. But I think that there's a logic here with regard to the green economy. I mean, fundamentally, the moral claim has to be if you're going to have a green economy, you shouldn't have any throwaway resources. You shouldn't have any throwaway species. You also shouldn't have any throwaway people. And that you know, we shouldn't just have a green movement about reclaiming thrown away stuff. It should also be about reclaiming thrown away lives and thrown away communities. So on the one hand, people need to know, yes, there's a gun at your head. And more importantly, it's a gun at the head of your children and your children's children. And it's trying to force you through a door that once you open it, the world is a whole lot better with a lot more, again, work, wealth, better health for you and for your family. And global partnerships, if we help the whole world boot up in a clean way, rather than fighting the world over the last drops of oil. When people see the stick, they'll get somewhat motivated. But when they see the carrot of a much better future for our children, I think they'll be able to sustain that motivation, and that's how it all works together.
That was Van Jones, founder of Green for All and author of The Green Collar Economy. Contact the group by calling area code 510-663-6500. Or visit their website at greenforall.org. Reports that home prices fell a record 16.6% compared with the third quarter in 2007, combined with the news of the $20 billion federal bailout of financial giant Citigroup, in addition to the $25 billion the feds have already given to the bank, signaled more bad news in the unstable U.S. economy. President-elect Barack Obama, attempting to calm the waters of uncertainty in this volatile financial climate, announced his economic team that will join him in confronting the crisis when he takes office in January. He named New York Federal Reserve President Timothy Geithner as his nominee for Treasury Secretary and former Harvard President Lawrence Summers as Director of the National Economic Council. Economist Christina Romer will be director of Obama's Council of Economic Advisers, and Melody Barnes was named director of his Domestic Policy Council. Peter Orszag, current head of the Congressional Budget Office, was selected to be director of the Office of Management and Budget. Geithner, Summers, and Orszag all worked in the Clinton administration under former Treasury Secretary Robert E. Rubin, now director of troubled Citigroup. While a rising star in the 1990s, Rubin promoted free trade, deregulation, and balanced budgets, the recipe many observers feel contributed to the current economic meltdown. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who coordinates the Working Group on Extreme Inequality. Collins assesses Barack Obama's economic team and lays out a progressive approach to confront the nation's current economic crises.
It's sort of the Clinton economic team returning, claiming that they've evolved, and that they're not just apostles of unfettered free markets and deregulation and free trade, but that they actually support bold economic stimulus and much more rigorous regulation. But you know, Larry Summers, Robert Rubin, they all presided over. They have a lot of responsibility for the current economic mess. They made decisions and choices to not intervene to prevent the bubble economics around technology and housing.
Now, what about Timothy Geithner, who's named as the new Treasury Secretary? Certainly, he's going to have a central role here. And he's had a long track record in various Democratic and Republican administrations.
He's a good pick in some ways. He doesn't come from Wall Street. He comes out of the New York Fed, which has been one of the more active Feds in terms of being engaged in oversight of the banking sector. He knows something about regulation. He's not considered an ideologue one way or the other. So he's considered a fairly safe and good pick. You know, unlike the current Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, he doesn't have quite as many confused conflicts of interest. You know, he's just not a creature of Goldman Sachs or Citigroup or any of the big Wall Street firms.
Chuck Collins, there's been talk about, a well-funded infrastructure reconstruction program across the country, fixing roads, bridges, schools, research facilities. What do you make of that? Do you think that will help the economy along? Will it pay off in terms of a long-term investment for the country as a whole?
You know, we have had so much deferred maintenance. We've been borrowing at the federal level, but not making the kinds of investments we should be making in infrastructure and transportation and energy. We've been borrowing to pay for the war. We've been borrowing to give tax cuts to the rich. We're living on our grandparents' infrastructure. And I think that the sort of consensus emerging is we need an economic stimulus along the size of, $500, $600 billion that could go to communities. And the beauty of that is it's going to be invested at the local level. So the impact of that will be very, very positive. And it's just too bad that we haven't been doing it for the last 10 years, and that's unfortunate. But the good news is there seems to be a consensus among the incoming administration to jump right on that.
Now, you wrote a column recently where you propose what you call a Main Street recovery package, a progressive recovery package. You want to summarize the larger points in that for our listeners?
Our basic plan is what we would call this bottom-up economic stimulus. Part of that is aid to the states. And this happened during the Depression, and this happened during previous recessions. The federal government will borrow money and send it to the states on a per capita basis. Almost every state is plunging into fiscal distress, experiencing tax revenues falling off and needing to lay off or cut services at a terrible time. So aid to the states has to be part of this plan. And then we propose about $900 billion of revenue. So instead of adding it to the debt, we argue that Congress should pass tax on the purchase and sale of stock, should have a one-time high income tax surcharge, or until the bailout is paid for, incomes over $2 million or even over $5 million should be taxed at a 50% rate. So those are the components. I guess, in addition, there's just things that we should do to sort of stop the bleeding at the local level, a moratorium on foreclosures, hit the pause button there, and do the workouts and as much as possible keep people in the homes where they live.
Well, Chuck Collins, just a final question, if I could, and that is, you know, a lot of people are looking at what's going to transpire with the Barack Obama presidency to see if we really turned a corner on the orthodoxy of Ronald Reagan and the Republicans that came after him as boosters for the orthodoxy of unfettered free markets, deregulation, and privatization. Do you think that particular economic philosophy is going to be on hard times in the coming years, or are we going to see revival of that stuff again?
Well, there's some pretty powerful interests that support that view of the world and that economic view, and I think that this is where your listeners and people are really paying attention right now to what's happening in the economy. They realize we're at the kind of at the beginning of the unwinding. We're not at the end. That this isn't just a hiccup, and that there's some big changes that lie ahead, and we can't go back to some sort of economic model of growth that was based on the grotesque inequality of the last 30 years. We can't go back. We can't go back to an era of cheap energy. So we have to look at organizing the economy in a way that works for everybody. And that isn't just sort of back to status quo, unfettered free market capitalism. So I think this is a time when we really have to push hard through education and politically and to have conversations at the community level to really understand that the crisis that we're in was a public policy failure. It was a human-created disaster because of a view of economics, this unfettered capitalism. And we'll be much better off if we have a better balanced form of capitalism with less inequality and broader prosperity, like a lot of European countries and like the U.S. in the 30 years after World War II.
That was Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who coordinates the Working Group on Extreme Inequality. Contact IPS at area code 202-234-9382 or visit their websites at ips-dc.org and extremeinequality.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.